from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, these are tough times for most arts groups, but one of the most affected locally is Sacramento Ballet. We'll talk with some of the company's dancers to hear how the uncertainty has affected them and what they're doing about it. Plus, we check in again on the idea of a White House farm. It sounded like a far-fetched dream, but recent events in both Washington and Sacramento suggest the idea has gained some traction. And a new Insight feature starts today. It's called Sound Advice, and it's all about introducing you to interesting new music. First, how do California voters feel about the budget measures on the May ballot? If the measures fail, the recent hard-fought budget deal will unravel. And right now, it looks like that might happen. A recent statewide survey found only one of the budget measures has majority support. Joining us is Mark Baldessari, President, CEO, and Survey Director of the Public Policy Institute of California, which did the survey we're referring to. Mark, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the proposition that voters seem to like a lot. Which one is it, and how popular is it?
Well, of the six, there's one measure that gets more than majority support, and that one gets overwhelming support. And that's Proposition 1F. And that measure would prevent pay increases for state elected officials during budget deficit years. 81% support that measure, 78% of Democrats, 83% of Republicans, 89% of independents. I think, in itself is a window into the voters' minds right now. Overwhelming support for preventing pay increases for state elected officials.
Is 81% support an unusually high level of support for a proposition?
Well, you know, there are some that get that level, but for in the context of what the other measures are getting, that's an unusual amount of support.
The proposition in this budget package of measures that has the least support right now is 1C, and 1C only has 37% of voters in the PPIC survey saying yes. What's Prop 1C about?
It's an initiative that would modernize the lottery system and allow for $5 billion of borrowing from future lottery profits to help balance the budget. We have seen in all the polling that we've done leading up to asking about this specific ballot measure that voters are not keen on the idea of taking lottery money and using it for purposes other than what historically a lottery money has been for, which is to go to schools, whether it's new money or future money or however it's described. Voters are reluctant, and in our poll, 50% of voters say that they would vote against that. That got the highest no vote. $5 billion and lottery profits. I think those are the concerns.
Of the five propositions that don't have majority support from voters, the one that's closest is Prop 1D, which has 48% of people saying yes. What's 1D about?
1D would temporarily provide greater flexibility in funding to preserve health and human services for younger children. It would take some of the money from the children's services from an earlier proposition that passed and temporarily use that money to balance the state budget. I think that the reason that 48% support 1D and then 47% support 1E, which would sort of do the same thing with some mental health funding that had previously been supported by voters at the ballot box, is that these are smaller amounts in terms of how they're described as smaller amounts of money. And my guess is that when people heard the fiscal impacts of 1D and 1E, they thought, well, these aren't as big as the numbers that are being described for other measures.
Perhaps the most significant of the measures is the first one, Proposition 1A, that would change the budget process by increasing the state's rainy day fund. What do voters think of that one right now?
Well, right now, just 39% of voters say that they would support Proposition 1A. That's somewhat surprising because voters have generally said that they like the idea of, setting aside money for rainy days and things of that sort. But my guess is that when read the ballot title and label, that what's going on with 1A is that they have concerns about the fiscal impacts fiscal impacts are described as higher state tax revenues of roughly $16 billion from 2010 to 2011 through 2012 to 2013. So that may be really for voters the concern, that big amount of money. And, of course, behind that amount of money, of course, is the word tax.
We're talking about the latest PPIC statewide survey on a variety of things, but the top line is how California voters feel about the package of budget measures coming up in the May election. It's a special statewide election in May. Five of the six measures currently lack majority support among voters. My guest is Mark Baldessari of the Public Policy Institute of California. One thing that really stood out for me is that there's one demographic group in California that currently seems to like all six of the budget measures, mm-hmm. and that's Latinos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was very significant, too. There are two things that stood out for me. One is the strong opposition among Republicans, and the other is the strong support among Latino voters. Latino voters, I think, viewing this package as more important now to pass. Latinos tend to be more highly Democratic in their registration than non-Hispanic white voters, so it's partly a partisan issue, but Latinos also younger voters, and younger voters also more supportive. So I think you have the combination of the youthful voters and Democratic voters being more supportive in this case, and perhaps also the coastal versus inland. These are more likely to be coastal voters as well.
These budget measures are being promoted by the Democratic leaders in the legislature and Republican Governor Schwarzenegger. Mm-hmm. Now, yesterday at an event, one of Capital Public Radio's reporters recorded the governor talking about this issue. He wasn't specifically responding to a question about the PPIC survey, mm-hmm. although he did subsequently refer to it. So mm-hmm. he had this in mind. Let's listen to what he said.
We are going to work very hard, both parties, to go up and down the state and educate the people to make sure that they win, because a failure here is no option, because it will mean an additional $13 billion in deficit for the states. It will be disastrous.
Well, according to the survey, the voters don't seem very impressed with this budget package. Do you think they see this in the same way that the governor does, that if they turn it down, that this package down, that the budget deal will unravel and there'll be a multi-billion dollar deficit reappearing?
I don't think the voters see the consequences of the measures at this point, and I don't think that they, at this point, would understand all the details that led up to them. This is a very complex set of measures, if you read each one of them individually, you don't necessarily have a sense of how they fit together and how they fit into the budget package. I will say, though, that when we asked voters specifically, we said, knowing that the governor and legislature put these six measures on the ballot as part of their budget package, does that make you look more favorably towards them? Only one in four said that they felt more favorably towards the measures, knowing that the governor and legislature put them on the ballot. And that's probably because only about a third of the voters currently approve of the job the governor is doing, and only 11% approve of the job the legislature is doing. So I think the governor and the legislature will have to work very hard to explain to voters, and they probably will need help from others. Get the support needed for the majority vote on all six measures.
It's astonishing to think that this will be the 14th statewide election this decade. Any signs in your survey of ballot fatigue among voters?
Surprisingly, and maybe the most surprising finding of all, was that a majority of voters said that they were happy to be asked to go to the vote in the polls again in May. And I think they're happy because they don't approve of the job the governor and legislature are doing right now. So they feel like they're being called upon to make decisions that that need to be made. They're not exactly sure why and what and so forth, and lots to learn in the next 2 months. But they're prepared to be called upon to go and vote again.
Finally, Mark Baldessari, another thing that stood out for me in the survey findings under the category of the general mood of the voters was that 22% of the people who responded think things in California are generally going in the right direction. And when you think about all the challenges that are going on right now in California, the nation, and the world, it'd be interesting to speak to some of those people.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, for not everyone, not everyone's experiencing the problems with housing and unemployment that that many Californians are facing today, and many Californians are optimistic about you know, even the short term, because they feel better about what's going on in Washington in terms of the leadership of the president and the Congress today, and I think that's leading many people to think that you know, we're going to get out of this economic situation and the fiscal situation, and better days are either here or soon to be.
Yeah. Mark Baldessari, President, CEO, and Survey Director of the Public Policy Institute of California. The PPIC just released a statewide survey on how California voters feel about the package of budget measures in the May election. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, how the dancers of Sacramento Ballet are dealing with a financial crisis that threatened their company's future. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions. Send them to insight@capradio.org. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, the recession is global. You'll hear how it's affecting people in Dublin, Johannesburg, Mexico City, and beyond. Plus a conversation with the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights about how the international community is dealing with human rights abuses in places like Sudan and Sri Lanka. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. These are tough times for most arts groups, and one of the hardest hit locally was Sacramento Ballet. In fact, for a while late last year, the company wasn't even certain to survive. The biggest problem was slow ticket sales for the annual production of the Nutcracker, which helps pay for everything else. How are the dancers of Sacramento Ballet dealing with all this uncertainty, and what are they doing to help ensure the company's future? Three of the dancers join us. They're Megan Staffens, Gabriel Williams, Alexander Cunningham. Welcome all to Insight.
Thank you.
What was it like for you, the dancers, when you heard the company was in serious financial trouble? Alexandra.
It was really tough. I think a lot went through our minds when we were first told that our company might not survive. We were pretty scared, especially of thinking that we wouldn't survive. But a lot of good has come out of this, and we've been able to kind of band together as dancers and come up with campaigns to help save our company.
Your parents happen to be the directors of the company. What kind of conversations did you have with them at home about all this?
Well, I don't actually live at home anymore, but we had a couple conversations about it. But mostly we just talked about what we could do to save the company. We didn't even go into a discussion about really what would happen if our company folded and where would I go next. I briefly considered going back to school, but then I thought, I really do love dance and I really want to make it work here. I love our company. I really want to dance here Sacramento Ballet.
You thought about going back to school because of the financial problems?
If our company had folded, I thought about, you know, maybe that would be a safe option. It sounds secure going to school. It sounds like there's a future in going to school, whereas when our company was having a hard time financially, it sounded really insecure. But I, like I said, I do love our company, and I know that I wanted to make it work here. So,
Megan, you're in your second season as an apprentice, so you're earlier in your career than Alex and Gabriel. What was it like for you when the company, I guess, probably all got together and had a meeting and it was laid out where things were?
It was definitely, like Alex said, it was very upsetting to hear that this company that I've grown to love and respect everything that we stand for and what we do in through our performances in the community. It was definitely tough to hear, but being, you know, a little bit earlier in my career, I definitely thought that I just can't imagine right now dancing anywhere else, and wanted to join with the dancers to do everything and anything I could to help.
Well, after the problems with the ticket sales for Nutcracker were announced, the company canceled quite a few shows at the Sacramento Community Center Theater, and they've been partly replaced, and you could make the case more than replaced, by a whole bunch of much smaller scale shows. Gabriel Williams, what did the dancers think about this transition mid-season from big shows, smaller number of big shows at a big theater, to a larger number of much smaller, even more informal shows in smaller venues?
Well, I think our first reaction to that was one of some disappointment. There was a lot of work that I was really looking forward to doing in the big theaters. But I think that since those shows were canceled and we've replaced them with a ton of studio performances, we realized how valuable that's been to the community. I think when we perform in the studio, our tickets are a little cheaper and the audience is more intimate. They're seeing us in a different way than you see us if you come and see us at the theater. And what that's doing is, I think it's causing people to fall in love with us all over again and see us in a new light, to see the work that we do in the studio, how much we put into it, to see us sweat. We also have been much more active in the community since our other shows were canceled. We've been forced to go out, and I think that the act of trying to build new audience space is really a helpful thing, and has been a really good thing for us.
Talking with dancers at Sacramento Ballet, the company came under severe financial pressure late last year and has made some big adjustments mid-season, and the dancers are actively involved in trying to improve the company's finances to ensure its future. Alexander Cunningham, a lot of companies, arts companies, contract with people for specific shows, like the opera, the B Street Theater. They bring in actors, singers, whatever, for those particular shows. Sacramento Ballet is unusual in the respect that you're all full-time members of the company. Yeah. Were you worried you were going to lose your jobs?
We were worried about that, but we didn't really spend much time thinking through the possibility of losing our job, because we went right into coming up with ways to save our company. We didn't really spend much time fretting over, you know, losing our job and not being able to live and work in Sacramento. We went right into what can we do to save the ballet.
Well, and what kind of ideas did y'all come up with?
Well, I think one idea that we came up with that's been really successful is our ballet business campaign, where we approach local businesses that we frequently patronize and love, such as coffee houses, restaurants, even bars, and we ask them to support the ballet by displaying a poster saying that they're a ballet business, and to either hold a day where they donate a percentage of their sales to us, or by donating an item for a silent auction or some other services in a way. And that's been really successful because it's brought us out into the community and it's brought local businesses to the ballet. In return, we advertise these businesses on our website and try and promote them as much as possible. We, you know, try and bring our friends to these businesses that are supporting us. And yeah, I mean, like the Beach Hut, if Gabe wants to talk about the Beach Hut
event. We had an event at the Beach Hut Deli. And it was on a Saturday, and they about doubled their sales for a usual Saturday. So it was a significant increase in sales for them, and then they donated something to us. So it was a really mutually beneficial relationship. And the Ballet Business Week is going to be next week. We're starting on Monday with that, and there are five businesses: Ararity Jewelry, Rubio's, Fresh Mexican Grill, Heavenly Yogurt, Firefly Salon, and Zuda Yoga that are all going to be involved in that.
Now, tell us about these living sculptures where you're doing sort of like dancing in very informal places. Megan, you're smiling.
Oh, well, they're actually, there's a lot of fun to do. We've been doing them on the second Saturday. So a bunch of people out on the street can come in to local art galleries, where we've had a couple of our dancers at galleries all throughout Midtown. And what we do is we improv just by feeling the the movement and the how you, we do it with partners.
So it's all on the spot. It's all
We make it up as we go along, and we have our flyers for all of our upcoming shows and events that we can hand out. And it's really, we've gotten a really positive response from that because people see us in a different way and see that we're just interested in supporting our company and doing everything that we can for us.
And another event that's coming up this season, Inside the Director's Studio, you're going to be learning a ballet from scratch, and that's going to be the show. And I'm just wondering how y'all feel about all of this stuff, because I'm guessing there are some professional ballet dancers who would feel they're somehow above all this kind of stuff. Is there any of that, Gabriel?
I don't think anyone feels that they're above anything we're doing. I think we all recognize how valuable it is, and allowing the audience to come into the studio and see parts of the process that they don't normally see can be really interesting for a lot of people. You know, when we have people come backstage at the theater and see the workings of the theater from the back and maybe watch a show from the wings, usually there are a lot of people who like that even more than seeing a show from the front. And that's kind of like what's happening with our in-studio shows. People are seeing, you know, when we're dancing on stage, the goal is to make everything look effortless for the most part, to try and hide all of the effort and the work that goes into what we do. But when you come to the studio, you can't help but see how much work we put into it. And learning about the process that goes into it and how much time and energy is involved in with what we do, I think is really interesting and kind of inspiring for a lot of people.
Ballet seems to me to be very challenging physically. What's it like on you all doing more shows and dancing on surfaces that are not usually surfaces for ballet dancers, Alex?
Well, actually, one plus side is dancing in our studios. We're used to that environment. We practice there all day long. The studio is a special floor. It's marley with it's a sprung floor, so it helps us when we are landing from jumps not to hurt any of our joints or our bones. So actually, a plus of performing in our studios is that we already feel so comfortable in the studio that just putting an audience in front of us, there's, of course, always going to be butterflies right before you perform, but there's not that extra edge of performing in a big theater and seeing a big black void in front of you and lots of lights. It's much more comfortable for us, I think, to perform in the studio, even though the audience is so close. Mm. As far as performing at art galleries for these living sculptures, it's not really that strenuous on our bodies because we're not really doing anything too strenuous, such as jumping on concrete or anything. We're moving very slowly and just trying to work with our partners and show the people that are coming to our galleries how versatile we are. We're not just tutus and pointe shoes. We do a lot of contemporary work. We do a lot of different kinds of ballets and dance.
Most organizations, whether it's government or nonprofit or for-profit, are under financial pressure right now. Mm. And Capital Public Radio is among them. So I know from experience that the mood is kind of somber in a lot of places. Megan, what's the mood like now at Sacramento Ballet, you know, just during the regular course of events when you show up for work? Are people smiling? Are they looking concerned or what?
Well, the great thing about the Sacramento Ballet is even when we found out that our season and the company was in jeopardy, of course, at first we took the second to, it was upsetting, but right away, everybody was so proactive and so energized, and we were ready to fight and we were ready to get out there. And when we come to work every day, it's great. Everyone is still smiling. We're excited to perform. We're always excited to do what we love to do and share the gift that we have with everyone. So,
Gabriel, go ahead.
Dance companies are kind of a unique entity. We're really kind of like a family. We work with each other so closely all day long. We partner with each other. And I think that really has helped us stay positive through this because we have a really, really strong sense of community.
Do you have ideas or have you heard other ideas from the dancers about the long term? Obviously, you're getting through the season, but what about the long term for Sacramento Ballet? What do you think needs to happen?
Well, I think a lot of the things that need to happen are happening. when there's any kind of economic distress, it makes an organization examine where the money is going and what we're doing. And I think that a lot of that has been happening. We have a really wonderful man named Stephen Libman, who's been an executive director at Pittsburgh Ballet Theater and the La Jolla Playhouse, who's been helping us while we haven't had an executive director since January. So he's helping us with that. And besides that, you know, we're working to get into our new building, which is going to be a joint venture among all the arts organizations in town. And that is...
That's an office rehearsal space with the opera, the Philharmonic, and others.
And the theater, yes, musical theater, California Musical Theater. That, I think, will go very far toward establishing a lot of security for the ballet, because we'll be able to have a school, a much bigger school, which I think is a very important step for the company to take as far as security goes. But again, I think rethinking the way that the organization is run, streamlining as much as possible, is a really positive outcome of what's happened. Not that, you know, Sacramento Ballet has always been run extremely well and is quite exceptional as far as dance companies go.
And Alexander Cunningham, it's not your decision to make, but is it your understanding that the Nutcracker is coming back at the Community Center Theater?
Yes, it is. And actually, our first performance of the Nutcracker next year will mark the 500 performance of Ron Cunningham's Nutcracker. So it'll be a really exciting show, actually, our opening of Nutcracker.
Are there going to be as many performances as in the past?
Hopefully so. I believe they're planning on as many shows as we've done in the past. So, yeah.
And finally, I'll just note, you co-designed the Save Our Sacramento Ballet website, the dancers' website.
Yeah, it's been actually a really fun and interesting experience learning how to do web design. Megan also has been really helpful with a lot of the computer stuff. We're dancers, and so we spend all day, pretty much 6 days a week, refining the art of dance. So we don't spend much time on computers, but it's been a really great learning experience learning how to do this, and I think we've gained a lot of valuable skills out of all of this. So.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us. It's been interesting to follow what's happening at Sacramento Ballet, and we wish you the best. That's Alexandra Cunningham. She's a Sacramento Ballet dancer, been with the company for 4 seasons. Gabriel Williams, also for 4 seasons. And Megan Steffens in her 2nd season as an apprentice. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we check in again on the idea of a White House farm following the news that Michelle Obama is creating a produce garden. And Maria Shriver wants something similar in Sacramento's Capitol Park. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous Insight, it's okay. Check out our archives at capradio.org/insight. The murder of a Modesto woman 21 years ago and her mother's search for the killer is the subject of a new book. Tomorrow in Insight, the victim's stepdaughter tells you why she wrote the book and what she learned from it. Also, you'll meet 3 local winners of a statewide competition for young classical musicians. And we'll get an update on the tentative plans to redevelop Cal Expo, including a new arena. You might recall a couple of months ago we talked with a local woman who was one of 4 nominees for White House Farmer, an unofficial position that has not been created by the Obama administration. She's Margaret Lloyd, a UC Davis graduate student of plant science. Well, there still isn't a White House Farmer. However, the general idea of using the White House grounds to grow crops seems to have gained a little traction. Last Friday, First Lady Michelle Obama and a couple of dozen school children broke ground on the south side of the White House for a produce and herb garden. And yesterday, there was a local angle. California's First Lady Maria Shriver announced she plans to create a produce garden at Capitol Park in Sacramento. We thought we'd check back in with Margaret Lloyd. Margaret, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeffrey. It's great to be back.
Well, how did you react when you heard that Michelle Obama had broken ground for a produce garden at the White House?
Well, it was one of the most exciting days, I must say. I think it's fantastic that Michelle Obama took the great step. She is a lady who has never gardened before, and she took the initiative to dig up the White House lawn and to show us what healthy eating is, and by planting these fresh fruits and vegetables on the White House lawn.
Do you think that this was perhaps inspired by this national campaign to create a farm at the White House that would create crops that people could eat?
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Certainly. There were several groups of people around the country spreading the awareness about the importance of local food raising and home food raising to address some of our nation's challenges. So I think that she certainly heard the public's voice in all of this and many of the leaders as well. And it collectively, I think, helped launch this White House farm.
I read in a news report that the crops will include spinach, broccoli, lettuces, kale, collard greens, herbs, blueberries, blackberries, and raspberries. Does that sound like a reasonable mix for growing in Washington, D.C.?
Definitely. It's pretty great that even though it's still chilly out, they took this initiative to plant the garden now and to set in motion around the country the option of spring planting anywhere as the season warms up around the country.
Now, as
so
I
it's still chilly in D.C., and those are great crops to be growing now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as I mentioned, Maria Shriver wants to do something similar in Sacramento to convert part of the east end of Capitol Park and turn that into a working produce garden. Had you heard word of that?
Yeah, she announced it on Tuesday, which was great news as well. And so I think the word is spreading around the country about the fact that anybody can plant a vegetable garden at their workplace, at their home place, at their schools, etc. So I think Maria Shriver's been a great example. And the fact that she's using a public space and a political space, I think, is really important for the message of farming and the future of food growing. The fact that we have both policy that influences our food choices, and then from the bottom up, we have the people who are actually consuming the food. And so by getting people engaged in the food growing, and they mentioned that they'll be offering this food to local food banks. So I think it's great that we're using public space to grow food for a part of our community that is food hungry.
I read that the area that's going to be converted in Capitol Park is currently a flower bed. Isn't that a perfectly legitimate use for this ground? It's not like it's asphalt.
Right, most definitely. And I think there are a lot of spaces that are still in soil where we're growing ornamentals of sorts. And so that's sort of the beauty of soil and plants is that we can change them and grow them according to what we need and what opportunities we have at hand. So turning in a already used piece of soil into a more useful one for growing food, I think, is a great way to be using that piece of land at the Capitol building.
And finally, Marga, any suggestions about what they might want to consider growing in this new produce garden on Capitol Park in Sacramento?
Well, it's always the most exciting part is what do we get to grow? And we have the great luxury in California to grow almost anything we want. So, you know, we can be growing things for our salads this summer, like tomatoes and basil and peppers. We can be growing things to cook as our vegetables, like green beans or carrots. But most importantly, we want to ask the people who are going to be eating it what they want. If there's a local food bank that they're donating it to, ask the folks there, what do they like to eat? Is there something that they haven't had since they were a child or that they missed from home? So if they're going to be eating it, they should be eating what they want, and that way they'll be eating more vegetables and incorporating it into their diet, which would be fabulous.
Well, we've been talking about the new produce garden at the White House, one that's planned for Sacramento's Capitol Park, and we've been talking about it with Margaret Lloyd, UC Davis graduate student who was one of four nominees for White House Farmer, an unofficial position that has not been created by the Obama administration, but the whole concept does seem to have generated a little bit of traction. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us again.
Great. Thanks for having me again, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a new Insight feature. It's called Sound Advice, and it's all about introducing you to interesting new music. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight interns get real responsibility and training. Find out more on the careers page at capradio.org. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, local and California news coverage is coming up on All Things Considered. Now, we debut a new regular feature on Insight. It's called Sound Advice. Every Thursday, Capital Public Radio music hosts will give tips on interesting new music for you to try. Over the month, we'll cover lots of genres, including classical, jazz, and blues. Today, we start with smart rock radio, the kind of music you hear on Off Air, Capital Public Radio's online show. Off Air's host joins us. He's also the person you hear during breaks, during Insight, and other programs on Capital Public Radio. He's Nick Bruner. Nick, welcome back to Insight.
Oh, hello, Jeffrey.
Well, before we listen to some music, Off Air is a fairly new show, and it's online only. For people who haven't heard it yet, what's it about? What kind of music do you play?
Well, essentially, I like to refer to it as music that's sort of the alternative to the alternative. It's underground, small labels, bands that you hear a lot on college radio stations that maybe you can't get on traditional FM airwaves.
Okay. Now, you have some artists, local artists, I think, for the most part, that you're going to talk about with us today. Who are we going to start with?
Well, we're going to start with a discussion about South by Southwest that wrapped up just about a week ago. And we had
a big music festival in Austin, Texas.
Indeed. It's been going on since, I think, the early 80s. And one of the bands that went down there this year, we had a lot from Sacramento. There was Two Sheds and Ganglions and Who Cares. Also down in Austin was a group called Agent Ribbons, who have been on this program.
Yes, two women, and they've got their own sort of quirky style of music.
And they put on a great live show. They're really fantastic. That was one of the very first concerts I ever saw when coming to Sacramento from Illinois. I moved here from a town that was full of kind of bad reggae bands and really well-meaning but really awful death metal bands. So when I saw a group like Agent Ribbons perform, I was just sort of blown away. And to hear they were going down to South by Southwest, I thought that was really exciting.
So what do you have for us?
Well, this actually comes from one of their, two produced records that are out. They have a full length, and they have a 7-inch single. And this is side A of that single. It's called The Wolf.
There was a time, though long ago, that came before you tamed me, when I ran wild with the beasts and no desire could claim me. My skin grew thick, my nails long, my hair all weeds and brambles. I bet my heart on every day, 'cause life is just a gamble. One day I found the winds had changed, and haughty in my notions had stopped a creature in its tracks by feigning false devotion. Oh, it was you, my little lamb, but just like in the fables, a wolf emerged from sheep's disguise and swiftly turned the tables.
It's kind of a almost melodramatic, almost like some old folk story that's being retold here.
Oh, I love it. It's Tom Waits meets the White Stripes meets Slater Kinney. And I hate to pigeonhole any band by saying, oh, they sound just exactly like these guys. But really, they do have their own incredibly unique style.
So they were at the South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin. Who else do you have for us?
Well, interestingly enough, NPR covered this next group. The Decemberists, they're kind of a bigger group, and they just released a new album called The Hazards of Love. 17 tracks long, and all of them marry into each other to tell the story of this spiteful queen and this talking fawn. It's very magical. It's very Pink Floyd meets Roald Dahl. And NPR broadcast the entire concert that played the full new record. And you can still catch that up at NPR's music sites, npr.org/music, and listen to that whole piece. And let's see, they play their new album in that entirety, and we have a reprise of one of the songs on there called The Wanting Comes in Waves. And here comes the wave, and the wanting comes in waves, and the wanting comes in waves.
It's interesting that they've recorded an album that's 17 tracks on one story, because nowadays, with the emphasis on downloading individual tracks, people have, a lot of consumers of music have gotten away from the whole idea of an album.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess bands haven't always signed on to that notion.
Well, certainly not this band. Yeah, this is something that they, I think, had announced prior to releasing this, that they said they were going to release not a concept record exactly, but a story record. And it's definitely it. A lot of soaring vocals, a lot of driving rhythms. It's very theatrical.
This is the first edition of Sound Advice. It's a new regular feature on Insight every Thursday. Capital Public Radio music hosts are bringing you interesting new music. Starting it off is Nick Bruner, who's the host of Off Air, Capital Public Radio's online music show. Its website is smartrockradio.org, and that's a good summary of what kind of music is on it.
I'm so nervous, I can't even tell you.
Who's next?
Let's look away from South by Southwest and turn our attention to an album that came out about a week and a half ago. The brand new album by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs is called It's Blitz. And that band's known for their dynamic frontwoman, Karen O. All their albums up to this point have had a real sort of drony, while still remaining catchy, tone. And It's Blitz sees the Yeah Yeah Yeahs more upbeat in tempo, if still biting and sarcastic lyrically. This is a track called Heads Will Roll.
Off with your head. Dance till you're dead. Heads will roll. Heads will roll. Heads will roll. On the floor.
Bit of an 80s vibe there. I can hear a little bit of Susie and the Banshees, maybe.
Maybe. It's definitely a song that can be acclimated for populist outrage, if you feel like, and then go dancing.
Who do we have now?
We have three guys, Peter, Bjorn, and John. This album actually isn't out yet. It'll be out on March the 31st, and the album is called Living Thing. It's a follow-up to their incredibly successful album, Writer's Block, and that album was about as big as a quote-unquote indie record can get. But the interesting thing, I think, about Living Thing, their follow-up, is that with major label support and all this extra production that they could have, it's much more stripped down. Instrumentally, there are fewer arrangements, simpler rhythms, and it isn't as poppy. So it's not exactly what you'd expect by an album that was picked up by a major studio. I think it's interesting that they fly against that convention. And to point that out, we have a...
What song do we have?
Oh, we have a track called Stay This Way.
Things ain't working out like they're supposed to, but at least they're working out. If you ask yourself if anything is meaningful, you find that everything is, no doubt. Call it lack of inspiration, resignation, stupid or mature. You can only do as much in little time. If you're up for sharing, I can split up mine. 'Cause it makes me happy.
I really like that. It's kind of sparse but very inventive production and arrangement.
It is. It's the whole record. That's a very good representation of the entire album. What I think is interesting is their newest record calls back to their old one in a way. Something really struck me about what they were touting off as their first single. And right now actually we have a sample of a song from their old album called Amsterdam. That was produced about 3 years ago.
Baby went to Amsterdam. She put a little money into traveling.
Okay, so now there's a part of that track, and here's a part of a track from their latest record. Now, if you listen really closely, there is a similarity in the lyrics. Put a little money in this type of thing. put a little money into traveling. And even the tempo is close. I've gone ahead and actually, well, here's what happens when you put those two tracks on top of each other. So you see, even rhythmically, they're so close that they kind of borrow from themselves.
That's nice.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah.
I just hope they don't, you know, sue themselves.
So that was a Nick Bruner mashup.
Yeah, really, really, really uneventful 15-second mashup, yeah.
Yeah, but it sounds good. Well, we're almost out of time. Anything else you'd like to play for us?
Yeah, sure. I've got one more track. In fact, we spend a lot of time in the latest episode of Off Air exploring the band Wolf Parade. These are five guys from Canada, all of whom are in about 100 other bands apiece. So we split up the band into individual members, and we play tracks from those individual members, and then we play tracks from the band, what they sound like when they're all together. So here's a cut from a group called The Handsome Furs, and this is Wolf Parade's singer and songwriter Dan Beckner and his wife Alexi Perry. And this song owes a lot to Chuck Berry, just right from the get-go. We were standing in the center of the occupation, caught between the ground and the gray, gray sky. Baby got a little bit of bad information. Baby take a number, maybe wait in line. I don't know, but I've been told every little thing has been bought and sold.
Yeah, interesting how he brings together this these synthesizers, but with this sort of old school rock and roll guitar.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's so loud and fun, and it's the only album I've ever seen that prominently places Vladimir Putin in the album art. It's in the very back. It's kind of creepy, but neat.
Great. Well, Nick, there's a new Off Air every Wednesday night, right?
Yeah, it posts every Thursday morning, technically. You know, the second it turns Thursday, so Thursday at midnight, that's when you can listen to the newest episode, and it's available kind of forever because we archive every one at smartrockradio.org.
Great. Well, check out Off Air, and this is the debut of Sound Advice, a regular Insight feature. We plan to do this every Thursday, so Nick will be back later. But over the course of the month, we'll be talking with all kinds of Capital Public Radio music hosts with interesting new music. Nick Bruner, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Mara Ponce and Nathan Wilkinson. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer was Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Modesto woman 21 years ago, and her mother's search for the killer is the subject of a new book. On the next Insight, the victim's stepdaughter tells you why she wrote it and what she learned from it. Also, you'll meet three local winners of a statewide competition for young classical musicians, and we'll get an update on the ambitious redevelopment plans for Cal Expo. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.